Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Up until the mid-20th century, children regularly died from diseases we never think about today. What changed? The advent of vaccines. Today, those of us in developed nations never think of diphtheria, tetanus, pertussis, polio, chickenpox, measles, mumps, or rubella. In fact, most of us could not identify the symptoms of diphtheria, don't even know what rubella or pertussis is. And that is because of the widespread use of vaccines in childhood. They have wiped those infections off the map. But now those diseases are making a comeback. Perhaps the most infectious of them all is measles. And since last fall, we have witnessed a rise in the number of measles cases here in this area. The breakout is centered, of course, in Spartanburg County, South Carolina, where yesterday they reported 962 cases. The number grows by the day and has spread to other areas of the Palmetto State, with just a few cases making their way to North Carolina. This is all because parents refuse to allow their children to receive what has become the normal regimen of childhood vaccinations. Pediatricians are still advocating for those vaccines, stressing their benefits and assuring parents of their safety, and yet that advice is occasionally falling on deaf ears, which is not only putting children at risk, but the rest of us as well. And it is resulting in burnout among pediatricians as they experience their best educated advice backed by years of scientific data being ignored. This hour, we explore why this is happening, its impact on public health, its impact on physicians, and how to find reliable information to counter the mis- and disinformation prevalent in some circles, and now coming out of the Trump-controlled CDC. We're joined in this effort by three pediatricians. Dr. Aaron Pankowitz is in general practice at Apex Pediatrics, serving the Cary, Apex, and Fuquay-Varina area. Dr. Elizabeth Portis is a pediatrician and Mecklenburg County Senior Health Program Manager for Prenatal through 5 Care Initiative. And Dr. Peyton Thompson is an assistant professor of pediatrics and infectious diseases at the University of North Carolina School of Medicine in Chapel Hill. Welcome to you all. Good morning, and thank you for being here.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
So, Liz, I'm going to start with you, Liz, because you're local and you're somebody in public health. How widespread have you found vaccine hesitancy to be among people in our service area?
Mike, thank you so much for that question. We know that vaccine hesitancy and specifically religious exemptions for vaccines have increased both locally and nationally. I do want to stress that the vast, vast majority of parents are still getting their children vaccinated and are still getting their children vaccinated on the recommended schedule. Last I checked in North Carolina, we have about a 3-4% religious exemption rate. Again, that means 96% of parents are getting their children vaccinated. There are specific dashboards that are available in North Carolina where you can look up both the prevalence of vaccination in your area, but also at specific schools.
And because it actually surprises me that we haven't had more cases in this area, but maybe you just explained why, because Spartanburg is only, 45 minutes away from Charlotte. And it could be that you're saying essentially that 96% of the young people in this area are vaccinated, and you only need 95% for herd immunity. Is that why we have so few cases cropping up here?
Yeah, Mike, let me review the data. So we actually have a 92% vaccination rate amongst our kindergartners. There are some medical exemptions as well. But you are correct. We need a 95% vaccination rate to have herd immunity. So we are close to that in Mecklenburg County. And in specific areas, too, we have that or greater.
So, Aaron, you're seeing patients every day, and new babies come along every day. So you're always admitting new children and new parents to your pediatric practice. Are you seeing a rise in vaccine hesitancy? Are you Are you having to have conversations explaining the need for these vaccines and the safety of them to parents on a regular basis or an increasing basis?
I definitely think we're seeing more parents coming in with questions. It's a really hard time to be a parent right now, and trying to figure out what the best ways are to protect their children. And that's what all parents want. And there's a lot of confusing and contradictory information out there on vaccines, not to mention just outright misinformation and disinformation. So we're definitely getting more questions around some of the routine vaccines than we have in a long time. I think parents have always come in wanting to talk to their pediatrician about questions around vaccines. But I think we're starting to see more questioning from parents about vaccines that are widely known to be safe and effective. And I don't think parents had given much thought until recently, when changes to the routine schedule have come out of the CDC, which are making them want to ask questions about things that before were kind of just standard clinical practice.
Yeah, because things are changing, and it's changing in large part, I guess, because of the internet and parents getting together on Facebook and other platforms, and all this mis and disinformation is spreading around. Are you finding that you are able to assuage any fears that parents have about giving their children these vaccines?
Yeah, I think every conversation is going to be a little different. I do find that most families come in with questions, but aren't firmly for or against vaccines one way or the other. I think we all know that vaccines are widely popular. And I do find that when we sit down and answer parents' questions and take the time to kind of thoughtfully go through the different things they're wondering about or have heard, most parents end up giving their kids the vaccines on a routine schedule, because at the end of the day, what they're trying to do is protect their kids, and they just want to feel like they're making the right choice for their kids, so that they don't worry they're making the wrong choice. And having a good doctor-patient relationship and having that trust is an important part of helping parents make a decision.
Because you're in clinical practice and you're seeing patients every day at your location, it seems to me that since measles is so highly contagious and easily spread, that you doctors would want young people, children, to be vaccinated so they don't bring these diseases into the office and spread them around with other patients who are there to see you for other reasons. What happens if a parent says, no, I'm not doing this? Do you keep them as a patient? What do you do?
So in our practice, we do have a vaccine policy that requires members of our practice by certain cutoff points to stick to the recommended vaccine schedule for North Carolina schools. That gives us an opportunity to have multiple conversations with the parents, though, before they have to decide one way or the other if they want to stick with our practice. And we clearly, like schools, make medical exemptions for those kids that can't get those vaccines. But the reason we adopted that practice is because we want to protect those patients in our practice that can't get the vaccines, the very young, like those kids under 6 months, those that have medical conditions that prevent it. And I think that's actually something that our patients really appreciate. I have more parents coming in that ask me if they need to get an early MMR vaccine right now than parents not wanting the MMR vaccine, because they want to make sure that their kids are protected from what many of our families know is a deadly or devastating disease for some people.
Peyton, we've been taking these vaccines, these childhood vaccines, for decades, it seems to me. And the protocols for when those vaccines are given has been in place for quite a while. And yet those protocols have now changed because under the direction of Health and Human Services Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr., the CDC has changed those recommendations. And that may be helping to increase distrust of vaccines. And yet this distrust predates Robert F. Kennedy Jr. and Donald Trump in the White House. So what's been driving it?
Yeah, that's a great question. Thank you, Mike. For as long as we've had vaccines, and in the case of measles vaccine, it has been available for 50 plus years, since 1971, there has been mistrust of vaccines. And so, You can find in vaccine history pictures of, children turning into animals and, just interesting children getting these pathogens, right, from the vaccines, which is just not the case.
Well,
and so,
let me ask you this then, because you're an infectious disease specialist. Is there any empirical evidence that these vaccines have caused any great amount of harm in the young people who get these vaccines? Any preponderance of negative outcomes as a result of following the protocols?
Yeah, that's a great question. And so I think we have to look at the data, right? So what I love to compare is the risk of an adverse event from the vaccine itself versus from the disease. And when we think about, for instance, seizures, with measles infection, we see 10,000 children out of a million having seizures induced by fever related to measles, versus 300 out of a million having seizures related to fevers from the vaccine. And so, these vaccines, we have so many decades, as you said, of data proving that they're safe. The real risks are that you might get some local site soreness, redness, and perhaps some fever. But those are really the main side effects that we can expect. And yes, rarely we see more serious side effects from these vaccines. But for instance, anaphylaxis only occurs in 4 in a million children. And so it's just the preponderance of evidence suggests that we should get these children vaccinated. Yeah.
Dr. Pankowitz.
And I think I'd just like to add to what Dr. Thompson's saying. I think one of the challenges for parents is, since these diseases, because of the success of vaccine campaigns, have become so much less common, they are not used to seeing the adverse outcomes or even the diseases that parents once were very familiar with, because so many kids had the negative impacts of them, right? And so now when they think about the shot, they're thinking about, well, what if something bad happens from the shot? But what they're not realizing is their kid is at so much more risk from the disease if these diseases come roaring back. And as you mentioned, without herd immunity, that's exactly what we're seeing.
Let me share with you what most people do. And I'm sure you know this. They all go to Google and they Google side effects of measles. And here's what comes up first in almost every search that I've done. According to the American Academy of Pediatrics, symptoms for measles include fever, cough, runny nose, red watery eyes, a skin rash. Big whoop. But that is not what the real problems are. The side effects for measles, I read last night, can be severe, they can be lifelong, and they can be incredibly detrimental, including blindness and brain damage, and of course, death. How often, before the shot came out, did measles cause those horrible things for people lifelong? Does anybody know? Because you guys have never really seen this. You're all too young. I don't know who to ask that question of. Anybody want to volunteer an answer? That's a pretty telling thing.
I don't have actual numbers here, but one particularly scary complication. So there are the routine complications that we can see for measles, such as ear infections, pneumonia, infection of the skin rash. Mm-hmm. And those are relatively treatable in today's world. But back before we had antibiotics, those were not treatable things, and those children could have died from measles
so
related.
So we have amnesia for what these diseases can bring.
And then
We have to take a break. Sorry. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. It's Charlotte Talks on listener funded 90.7 WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about measles, but mostly about vaccine hesitancy with three pediatricians. Dr. Aaron Pankowitz is in general practice at Apex Pediatrics in the Apex area. Liz Portis is a pediatrician and the senior health Mecklenburg County program manager for the prenatal through five initiative. And Dr. Peyton Thompson is an assistant professor of pediatrics and infectious diseases at the UNC School of Medicine in Chapel Hill. Liz, every pediatrician that our producer talked to for this program to get guests to join us for this conversation. Sarah D'Elia spoke every physician that she spoke with about this needless outbreak of measles used the same word, frustrating. As hesitancy becomes more prevalent for these and other childhood vaccines, has Mecklenburg County had to change its approach, become more aggressive in its outreach to convince parents, or are we some kind of an outlier county that still believes in vaccinations?
Right. Thank you for that question and the opportunity to talk about our work here in the public health department. I would say that we are a more vaccinated county than some, but we are also seeing increased vaccine hesitancy. And so we are taking the approach of targeted universalism. So that is a public health concept where we deliver the same overall message to people that vaccines are safe and effective, but how we tailor that message and who does that messaging is particular for each community or context. So our public health department has partnered with our school systems, our pre-K programs, our healthcare systems to really deliver vaccines and education where people are. So we have mobile clinics, for example, that are partnering with schools that we know have lower vaccination rates to get kids to vaccinate to answer parents' questions.
We vaccinate young children because they have no immunity for measles, mumps, rubella, diphtheria, tetanus, pertussis, polio, chickenpox, hepatitis B and A, and other diseases. And herd immunity, which is what we need to stop the widespread of these diseases, usually happens through vaccination. You don't really want to have it happen because you got the disease and you've become immune to it over time. And when herd immunity is achieved, that disease can no longer be as easily spread. I understand with measles, you need 93% to 95%. Herd immunity for polio, the number is a little lower, 80% to 85%. Peyton, as vaccine hesitancy proliferates, in terms of public health, what's at risk here?
Yeah, thank you, Mike, for that question. As you note, measles is one of our most infectious of the vaccine preventable diseases. And so it's no surprise that that is what we're seeing these days. And then as we go by virus, by pathogen, bacteria, we will see outbreaks of all of these different pathogens based on the herd immunity level that's needed, right? And as we have more and more children who are unvaccinated, we are going to see these pathogens rear their heads. And it's terrifying to think that we might see polio in our lifetimes again. But I think one of the scarier things about measles that parents don't probably know is that we can see brain infection or encephalitis. And that really is more common than you would think. It occurs in 1 in 1,000 cases. And then what's even scarier is subacute sclerosing panencephalitis, which leads to brain damage. And that occurs 7 to 11 years after infection and is more rare, thankfully. But there are 4 to 11 cases per 10,000 cases of measles. There even is death in 1 to 3 per 1,000 children, per the data that we have. So it's really scary. We have easy prevention. These vaccines work. So,
Dr. Portis, you wanted to join in, and so does Dr. Pankwitz. I'll start with Dr. Portis. Liz, go ahead.
To piggyback on what Peyton said, when we talk to our colleagues that have worked in other countries, they have experienced death by measles, and we are fortunate in the U.S. that we have very robust healthcare systems. And if a child shows up with measles or other complications of measles, our healthcare systems will do everything they can to improve the health of that child. And so we are very fortunate that we have that. And especially in Mecklenburg County, we have some very robust healthcare systems. But we know across the country, there are areas that do not have as many hospitals or as many pediatric specialists that we do in our urban centers.
Dr. Pankwitz.
Yeah, and I would just like that. It's sometimes hard to think about like numbers in the thousands and things, but like 1,000 kids in an elementary school is one dead student, unfortunately, right? If there's 1,000 infections, or bringing it home to a younger sibling that couldn't get the vaccine, right? We've already seen measles deaths in Texas. We've seen pertussis deaths in Kentucky, which is another vaccine preventable illness. So it's not like this can't happen today, even in a country like the United States with an advanced healthcare system. And most families haven't experienced that, thankfully, but we don't want to see them experience those kind of things again.
I've heard that measles, among all these childhood diseases that we vaccinate for, is among the more contagious, or maybe the most contagious of them all. If that's true, Aaron, what makes it so?
So different types of infections spread in different ways. And measles is one type of infection that is airborne, right? So it takes very limited amounts of time for a person to be in a room with somebody that has measles and sometimes may not even know it, for them to contract the infection if they're unvaccinated and then spread it to somebody else. And so that is one of the biggest reasons it is so highly contagious and so easily spread.
Peyton.
Sure. And I think we also have to think about how many susceptible individuals are at risk for infection from that one index case who's infected. And that number is 18 for measles. And so we thought about this a lot with COVID. That number wound up being only 3. So that just shows you how infectious, like 18 other people are going to get infected if you have measles and go into that waiting room, right?
Which explains the phenomenon we've been watching happen in Spartanburg, South Carolina, since the fall. These cases have proliferated. Yesterday, South Carolina reported 962 cases. That's 12 more than last week, up from 870 the previous week, which was up from 789 in the last week of January. This is happening in that area, Liz, because of unvaccinated children catching it and passing it on in school settings. And hundreds of these children have been quarantined, which is something I don't think any parent wants for their child. But what are the implications for public health of this outbreak and other potential outbreaks of other childhood diseases that are potentially there because people aren't getting their kids vaccinated? How widespread could this become, Liz, over time?
Thank you for that question. And to go on what Peyton said as well, this could be very widespread over time, and then we could see emergence of other diseases that we don't expect these days. We do know that people and diseases, they do not follow county lines. And so there is movement across the country, across cities, with exposures when there are high prevalence of measles to other counties.
So ever since the pandemic, the COVID-19 pandemic, and the required shutdowns that we issued across the country because of that, and the required vaccinations for COVID-19 to go back to work or to go back to school, the resistance to vaccines has been growing. But is it really that, or is this, Dr. Pankowitz, simply resistance by some people to being told what to do? They want the freedom to do with their bodies what they want, and they don't want to be told, and to the unraveling of the philosophy that we're all in this together?
So I think that's a complex question, Mike, because I can't speak for every individual person as to what their reasons for vaccine hesitancy or skepticism or just outright not wanting vaccines. I'm sure there's some people that don't want to be told what to do. I think there's other parents that very legitimately have questions or concerns, and they want to have their questions answered before they make a decision they can't take back with their children. And I think for those families, it's a lot easier once their questions are answered and decide to vaccinate, right? I think the other issue is herd immunity is a tough concept to understand, right? Like for a parent to say, well, I don't get this vaccine, but everybody else is getting the vaccine, then my child should still be safe, right? So why should I make a decision whenever I'm not, this isn't something I have to worry about, right? But you can almost think of it like a forest fire, right? Where there's too much dry brush, right? If you end up in a community without realizing it, right? And one of those measles cases walks into it and your vaccination rate is 85%, Well, it's like a spark that lights a flame in the whole community. And that's why certain communities see these large scale outbreaks. So I don't know why one parent versus another, unless they tell me in the conversation, decides what they feel about vaccines, which I hope they do tell me. And that helps open up the conversation and answer more questions.
There is this question about bodily autonomy, which I think is a legitimate question. It's my body. I should be able to do with it what I want. And I don't want to be forced to put something in my body that I think might harm me, or maybe you don't know completely, you're not completely sure that it won't harm me, so why should I do this? What's the answer to that as a pediatrician, Dr. Pankowitz? And Dr. Thompson, I'll come to you too on that.
So I don't believe that any pediatrician is walking into an office and giving kids shots that their parents aren't agreeing to, right? The bodily autonomy has always been there. We tell them what the recommended vaccines are. We tell them what the school required vaccines are. We ask them questions, we answer them. But before a child receives any vaccination or immunization, the parent agrees to it, right? So bodily autonomy is not being taken away. But at the same time, vaccines, as you have said, work on public health and communities agreeing as a whole that we don't want to see these diseases come back. And so that is what you need for that herd immunity that you've mentioned. So bodily autonomy is there, but communities have to make a decision to protect themselves together, right? And I'll let Dr. Thompson jump in with the rest of what she wanted to say.
Go ahead.
Sure, yeah. So just to say, you know, in terms of how vaccines work, and I think that's where we as pediatricians can help educate these families as to what they're actually being exposed to and putting in their bodies, because vaccines rely typically on antigens or proteins or polysaccharides that are part of the vaccines. And what they don't realize is that on an everyday basis, their child is exposed to millions of antigens and their body has protections in place. The skin is our first line of protection, you know, and we're protected against harmful antigens or pathogens. And remembering that these vaccines are protective or good antigens that we are putting in our body, similar to, you know, they're good bacteria that we have in our gut. We take probiotics sometimes because those help maintain gut our gut to be healthy. But, you know, antibiotics can kill the harmful bacteria in our body. And so, you know, I think just remembering that we have the tools to prevent these infections that are horrible. And we know how the immune system works, and we can use that to our advantage.
Dr. Pankowitz.
And just dovetailing after what Dr. Thompson said, right? I like to try and explain vaccines to parents as we are trying to prep the body's immune system to do what it should already be doing without the severity of actually getting the disease, right? You are getting a small part of a virus or a bacteria that cannot harm you in the way that the disease can harm you, so that your body can make immunity and make antigens antibodies to a very serious disease. So if they were ever exposed to it, they either prevent them from getting it completely, or they are at far, far lower risk of the serious complications that the disease can cause.
But that is why we have this schedule of childhood vaccinations, Liz. It's long established, and it's now under attack at both the federal and at some state levels. Last year, 10 states made it easier for families to opt out of these vaccines. And even as measles spreads in South Carolina, a law there under consideration in the legislature would prohibit any vaccines from being mandated for children under 2. In Florida, Republican Governor Ron DeSantis and that state's attorney general have been trying to eliminate vaccine requirements for school entry, and laws have been passed in New Hampshire, Texas, and West Virginia to make it easier to receive vaccine exemptions. We're not there yet, but what is your, as a public health official, Liz, what's your reaction to that?
As a public health official and as a pediatrician, I again look to the science that my colleagues on this talk have spoken about the safety and the efficacy of vaccines in preventing disease and keeping children safe. And as we know, and we have talked about, as the vaccine rate in a community drops, which these laws are likely to see after they pass, we will see more disease and more children will be sick.
And the MMR vaccination, Peyton, has traditionally been given on a schedule to protect against measles, mumps, and rubella. What does the scientific evidence show about the safety of those vaccines and the schedule on which they are given? Because that seems to be under question at the moment as well.
Sure, yes. So these vaccines are very safe. As I said, we have 50 plus years of data behind this to show us just how safe these vaccines are. I think in terms of the schedule, so the reason that we have these schedules is years and years and years of data and studies to show us that this is how children best respond to this vaccine, right? And so that is why we give it at the 12-month mark and then the 4 to 6 year mark. In cases of outbreaks, it is recommended sometimes to give an early dose of vaccine to a 6 to 12 month old. That dose, that early dose, doesn't count towards the series because we don't believe that the infant is going to have a high rate of immunity to that first dose. And so they will need the subsequent two doses as well. But we do know that after one dose, children, if they're given the first dose beyond 12 months, 93% of them will have protective immunity. And then we go up to 97 to 99% after that second dose.
Dr. Peyton Thompson, Assistant Professor of Pediatrics and Infectious Diseases at the UNC Chapel Hill School of Medicine. Liz Portis is with us from Mecklenburg County. And Dr. Aaron Pankowitz is in general practice at Apex Pediatrics. All three pediatricians, and we'll return in a moment. It's Charlotte Talks. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and WFAE.org. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about childhood vaccinations, vaccine hesitancy, and we're going to talk about pediatrician burnout in a moment because they've been facing a lot of issues, including vaccine hesitancy, that are causing them to rethink, maybe I should have gone into car repair. Dr. Aaron Pankowitz is with us. He's in general practice in pediatrics at Apex Pediatrics. Dr. Liz Portis is a pediatrician and the senior health Mecklenburg County Program Manager for Prenatal Through 5 Initiative, the Prenatal Through 5 Initiative, and Peyton Thompson is an Assistant Professor of Pediatrics and Infectious Diseases at the UNC School of Medicine in Chapel Hill. We've alluded to this throughout this conversation, that measles, in its worst sense, can lead to death in a young person who is unvaccinated. And we are told among childhood viruses for which we vaccinate children, it is the most contagious of all of these. But only one child has died in the United States of measles since 2015, and that case was in the recent outbreak in Texas. No children have died in either North or South Carolina. So, Peyton, as a public health official, are we overblowing the fear of this disease? Is the fact that children aren't dying in great numbers increasing vaccine hesitancy?
I think we have to think, what if that were my child? Would I, have done anything differently? And that's a horrible question to have to ask and to have to pose, to ourselves as the parents of that child, right? One child is too many when we have prevention for this. And so it's just incredibly sad that misinformation has led to this.
And one pediatrician in South Carolina, Dr. Stuart Simcoe, calls measles, and I quote, a terrible, terrible disease that can cause mortality. Liz, even if a child doesn't die, this can cause high fever and misery and suffering for a child, and no parent wants to see their child in that situation. But if you agree, what makes this a terrible, terrible disease?
Mike, thanks for the question. As we have spoken about before, that this is not just a rash and a fever, especially for our youngest children that are very susceptible to measles and the secondary complications. We know measles can cause with immune amnesia, which Dr. Thompson had spoken about, which is your body can forget how to respond to other infections or viruses, and the changes in the brain with risks of encephalitis can make it extremely terrible. I know once during my residency, we were working up a child for the late complications that can lead to encephalitis and significant brain problems and death 10 years after you catch measles. So we don't know how these children who got over measles currently, how they're going to fare in the next 10 years.
We have a 50-year track record on most of these childhood vaccines, Dr. Pankowitz, and some of the same parents who might be reluctant to get their child vaccinated because they've heard about or they've read about or they've been misinformed about the side effects of these vaccines and the long-lasting damage that may or may not occur, in their opinions, are the same parents who are willfully taking these weight loss drugs for which we have no long-term track record. We don't know what's going to happen 10 years, 15 years down the road. I won't name any brand names, but they're all over television. How do you explain that phenomenon? And if you know that to be the case with a parent, is it easier to explain that we have a 50-year track record over here, but you're on this and we don't know?
I don't know if the human brain is great at that kind of thought and comparison. I think when a parent is in a room, they're just thinking about the decision in that moment and what they've read and what they're trying to answer. And I think honestly, one of the challenges with many vaccines is it's a shot, right? And nobody wants to see their child hurt. And so whenever it comes down to poking your little baby, it requires a parent to feel like they are making a really important, good decision to protect them down the line, and that the small amount of pain they're experiencing in that moment is well worth it, right? And it is also easier to make a decision about yourself than it is about your child, right? Like they are accepting a risk for themselves about something because of what they know is about to happen versus they're doing something to their child. And I think that can be very challenging for a parent. And it is a challenge for our brains as human beings. So I don't know that I use that line of thought when I'm trying to convince or talk to parents about whether or not they should vaccinate their children, because I think it could honestly lead to confrontation or mistrust in a way I don't want it to with a parent.
Dr. Thompson.
Yeah, so two comments related to what Dr. Pankowitz is talking about. Number one, when we think about alternative schedules, those children are getting more shots. Just putting that out there. But on the other hand, sort of playing the devil's advocate, I think we have to put ourselves in those parents' shoes to understand the confusion that they're going through as they make these decisions for their children. I think it's important to, as I'm sure Aaron does, develop rapport with these families for them to feel comfortable relaying their concerns to us so that we can then speak the truth.
The side effect, aside from the shot itself, which may hurt for a second, I think they hurt a lot more when you're a child than they do when you're adult because you understand that it's momentary and it's not going to hurt you. But what are the known side effects of this panoply of childhood vaccinations that we give kids? Do we see them in any widespread fashion, Dr. Thompson? Are they serious enough to be worried about? Are they long lasting? What are the side effects?
Yeah, so as I alluded to earlier, the common side effects of vaccines are soreness at the injection site, potential redness at the injection site, and fever. But those are really easy to deal with when it's all said and done, and when we think about the risk benefit, and preventing these serious illnesses. There are more rare side effects, and both we as pediatricians, when we see those side effects, we report them. Parents can also report those side effects to the VAERS system. And so I think it's, important for us to remember that we have to keep in mind that there can be side effects. These are medications. All
Right.
medications have potential side effects, and we are able to track those. So.
So let me flip the coin here. We've talked a lot on this program over the last year or so about these vaccines and vaccine hesitancy. We haven't talked about what this does to you, pediatricians, doctors, who are on the receiving end of having to explain this over and over and over again. Doctors used to be treated like gods. Whatever they said, we just took for granted, and maybe that wasn't healthy. Maybe we're smarter now because we go to Google and we come into the office armed with a stack of information. Maybe these ads on television that say, "Ask your doctor if XYZ is right for you," is a good thing. I don't know. If it's a doctor, it would bother me. But they come in and they tell you, "Well, I've done my own research, and here's what I think." Explain to me, Aaron, why my research isn't as good as your knowledge and years of experience.
So I think a lot of it comes down to sources of information, right? And as much as you can find on the internet, it is all being pulled from many different places, right? Some of which are well-validated good sources and some of which are not, right? And so we've all gone to school and spent time studying these things. And one of the things I always tell parents when they're thinking about vaccines is all pediatricians are going out and getting their own kids vaccinated, right? And I try and direct them to trusted sources where I know they're going to get good information. So, the American Academy of Pediatrics, they have a website for parents, healthychildren.org. They also have their own like question and answer website for immunizations. And then one of the best resources I like to send parents to is the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. Vaccine resource pages because they go through almost every question that parents often ask about vaccines and answer them in really great detail to help parents kind of have good sources of information. And I think that's really important. And then them being able to trust me in the office as I answer their questions and having that rapport that Dr. Thompson alluded to that's so important in a doctor-patient relationship.
This all boils down to trust. People have increasingly become distrustful of institutions, from the government to science to medicine to the media. And when parents bring their children in to see their pediatrician, the pediatrician is somebody that you see on the regular basis. It seems that you would have established at some point a rapport with that doctor, or you would go to another doctor if you didn't like what they were telling you or how they treated you. One pediatrician has says that what she tries to do every day is not to allow this vaccine skepticism to make her feel despair or frustration. But how can you not? And now we're hearing that pediatrics is one of the top six specialties for physician burnout. You see patients every day, Dr. Pankowitz. What's causing that, aside from banging your head against the wall?
I think since COVID-19, all medical providers have seen an increase in burnout, and pediatricians certainly aren't immune to that. And right now, we're in a period of high vaccine hesitancy. We are seeing increasing rates of childhood mental health issues, and pediatricians are just being asked to do more and more. And I definitely know some colleagues have either cut back or decided to retire early. I think one of the greatest benefits, though, of being a pediatrician is as hard as a conversation might be in one room that I enter, the next room often is a sweet baby that is smiling when I enter, or a precocious toddler that just wants to tell me about like their day, and what they've been up to. And so those kind of experiences do help to buffer some of the other like experiences that I think we all deal with on a day-to-day basis that makes the work hard. But it is true that burnout has been increasing among pediatricians, and it's something I think we are continuing to work towards decreasing.
Dr. Portis.
To add on to what Aaron said, with my role in the county in the prenatal to five initiative, We are specifically working to build collaboration and infrastructure to improve health and well-being for this age population. We know that pediatricians can't do it alone, so we need all people that are working with children or families to be saying similar messages. We need, so we are partnering with early childhood organizations, nonprofits, our healthcare systems, and really building upon the early work of the county around early childcare and education that's been going on for decades, as well as programs within our county, like our case manager programs and our clinical programs and our community partners, so that we're all saying the same message so that our healthcare providers don't feel like they have to shoulder this conversation alone.
Dr. Thompson.
One unique population that I think we haven't touched on yet is the healthcare providers who do see the unvaccinated individuals and whose clinics do not have policies against seeing those individuals. And so I spoke to one clinic recently, a group of providers, and they said that they've been worried because surrounding clinics have started saying, oh, we're not taking unvaccinated individuals. And so this clinic is feeling the brunt of that. I think we have to keep in mind, you know, those clinics who feel obligated to provide care for these individuals and, you know, what can we do to support them as well?
I'm a little short on time, but I want to come back, Aaron, to something that you talked about a second ago, because you've recommended that if parents want to do their own research, there are some great places to go, among them the material produced by the American Academy of Pediatrics. But the American Academy of Pediatrics is now in conflict with some of the recommendations coming out of Washington and from the CDC. How do I, as a parent, figure that out? Who do I trust?
I think that is probably one of the most challenging things for parents right now. And I empathize with them, right? For years, we directed them to the CDC as a repository of vaccine information. And right now, we are directing them away from it, right? The American Academy of Pediatrics has done a good job of making sure that we have a schedule that is backed by science. And many, many other major medical societies have come out and said they are using the AAP schedule. It used to be, before we had a more standardized schedule, that there were a lot of different vaccine schedules and it was confusing for parents, right? Different organizations would put out different schedules. And so honestly, it is challenging when people don't have a pediatrician or doctor to help them get to the right source. And so that's where public health comes into play in trying to make sure they receive the information they need to go to the right sources.
Well, because of these conflicting sources of information, the CDC has normally been the gold standard, and now they're saying something different from the American Academy of Pediatrics and other doctor organizations as well. So where do doctors go? Who do you trust? Do you trust the CDC at all? Anybody? I'll open the floor. Go ahead, Peyton, go ahead.
I mean, I still go to the CDC for some resources that I know are trustworthy, but for the vaccination schedule, I now go to AAP.
Okay. Very quickly, I have 30 seconds, Liz. We haven't talked about this, but sometimes the children getting their vaccines are the only time that they see a doctor. And if they don't get their vaccines, they never see a doctor. How important is that in terms of public health? The fact that just because it's time for a vaccine, they actually see a doctor. 10 seconds.
Yeah. It's extremely important for the well-being of children to have a medical home and have a full assessment, both on their physical and their mental and emotional health.
Dr. Liz Portis is a pediatrician and the senior health program manager in Mecklenburg County for the Prenatal Through 5 Initiative. Peyton Thompson, assistant professor of pediatrics and infectious diseases at the UNC Chapel Hill School of Medicine. And Dr. Aaron Pankowitz in general practice as a pediatrician at Apex Pediatrics in the Cary area. Thank you all for the hour.
Charlotte Talks is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Our executive producer is Gabe Altieri. The senior producer is Sarah D'Elia. The producer is Chris Jones. For more information on Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or to subscribe to the Charlotte Talks podcast, visit WFAE.org/Charlotte Talks.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.